I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Jim Burris, in on this Tuesday for Rose Scott. Many African-American families still live in a state of confusion about loved ones who were killed during the Civil Rights era. A group from Syracuse University's Cold Case Justice Initiative is in Georgia for this summer to research the deaths of Black men and women that remain unsolved.
Joining us now, law school professor Janice McDonald from Syracuse and one of her students, Alphonse Williams, who is, of course, in the law school there at Syracuse, but is from right here in Atlanta, Grady High School graduate. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Professor, let's get the legal part out of the way here, just our definition of terms. When we describe something as a cold case here, what does that mean in terms of the unsolved cases of murders of African Americans during and perhaps even before the Civil Rights era?
Well, what we are thinking of as cold cases, because you can get confused with cold cases, there are lots of different kinds, but the ones that we're looking at are ones that have been defined by the United States Congress in the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act that was passed in eventually passed in 2008. But these are cases that occurred between 1946 and 1969. And we have evolved since then to look at cases that occurred in the 70s, 80s, and yesterday. But our primary focus, particularly this summer, is on those cases that have some racial motivation, whether it be by individuals, by a Klan organization, or by suspicious killings by law enforcement.
And did all of them involve African Americans as victims? Certainly, I would imagine most of them did.
But we had
the Leo Frank case here in Georgia, for instance, where the victim was Jewish. Was there some diversity in terms of victims here?
There are people who were allies, who were civil rights activists, who were people who spoke up on behalf of African Americans during the very difficult times.
I was reading you all are investigating about 196 cases currently. More than half of those 100 are actually from here in Georgia. Why so many?
Well, I would ask why we haven't found all of the cases. 196 is just a drop in the bucket. Nobody's ever done a full accounting of all the people who disappeared or who were killed during and our focus of 1946 through 1969. But as you discover now with the killings that are happening, people are just now starting to record every one of those. And so I would say to you, it's not 196. Matter of fact, we've identified 300 since then. But that's just a small amount. Nobody's just focused on this in every state.
Can you speculate what that number might be?
No. I think it's thousands. And I think it's ridiculous that the Justice Department is dealing with 120 and saying that's the list. They're not making the effort to find all of the suspicious cases of that time.
Why do you think that's the case?
I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that. I think the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act really in 2008 was probably one of the last bipartisan pieces of legislation. It was supported by just about everybody in Congress.
And quickly, some folks might not know who Emmett Till was. Can you explain that?
Emmett Till was a 14-year-old young man from Chicago. His mother sent him down to visit his relatives in Money, Mississippi. That's the way that was done oftentimes during this was 1955. And he with his cousins went to a store where a white woman owned the shop with her husband, and she claimed to her husband that he either whistled at her or made some comment. That night, the husband and another friend of his showed up at the relative's house, Moses Wright's house, and threatened the whole family with killing the whole family if they didn't turn over Emmett Till. They took Emmett Till out of the house, and they tortured him brutally, and then they drowned him. They chained him to a heavy metal piece of equipment and drowned him in the river. When his body was found several days later, the sheriff tried to bury it quickly, but Mamie Till Mobley, his mother in Chicago, insisted and got an order having the body taken back to Chicago. And when it got back there all nailed shut, she insisted on opening it. And when she saw what had happened to her son, she insisted on an open casket. And that open casket with a picture from Jet Magazine that was published worldwide, made a difference to a lot of people who lived in their own ignorance about what was going on in the South. It was an amazingly courageous thing for her to do.
And just to close the book, if you will, was that case ever solved?
There was a trial of the two white men right then in Mississippi. There's a wonderful Eyes on the Prize segment that documentary that tells the story of that. The jury, all white males, spent about 20 minutes. They acquitted them. And later on, I believe it's Look magazine, published an interview. They paid these two white men for an interview where they admitted to the killing.
Alphonse Williams, let's bring you into this. I mean, you're a young man from right here in Atlanta. What drew you into this project?
What drew me into this project was I'm studying for finals, and I believe I was watching the Trayvon Martin verdict. And then a couple of months later, you get the Ferguson verdict, and that adds to your fire. And of course, it is hard as a first-year law student to get a legal opportunity, but I turned down a firm job to do this because this was my passion. And to see, in working on this project, it's become eye-opening to see that you can't bifurcate what occurred in the, what they claim, the civil rights era of the 60s, the 40s, all the way until modern day with Ferguson. And a lot of people do claim that the civil rights era has ended, but it's ongoing. It's an ongoing process that we have to take each step at a time.
One of the aspects, though, of the older killings is that, and it's probably one reason why you're here, is that investigations at the time simply weren't done. The Emmett Till case, which we just heard about, was just one example. Whereas now, whatever the debate about the justification or non-justification for what happened, you know, whatever that is, there are investigations going on. It's almost impossible these days to not have cases brought up if there is a lapse in an investigation. Has there been at least some progress there, do you think, as a law student?
That's difficult to say. I still think, because back then they would do investigations as well, but that doesn't mean that you're bringing justice to the families. And I think that's the most important aspect of it, is bringing justice and closure to these families. So we can say that we did an investigation in Ferguson, but by acquitting the, or not even given the opportunity to have him, the police officer, presented in front of a jury, I don't think that's bringing justice to the families of Ferguson. Even if he is guilty of stealing $2 worth of merchandise, I don't think that gives him the right to be murdered in the streets. So that's not justice.
For those just tuning in, we're speaking with Professor Janice McDonald and student Alphonse Williams from Syracuse University's Cold Case Justice Initiative, and we're learning about how they investigate neglected deaths from the civil rights era. How hard is it? I mean, when you start right at the beginning, what roadblocks are you up against?
A lot. Just gathering the material is difficult. We start off from the ground bottom, building our cases from scratch. So we're in old archive newspapers. Just obtaining those is difficult in itself. And then once we get a little bit of material, now we have to reach out to different government agencies. And not only do they have a lot on their plate for current situations, now we're trying to add to their workload by getting things from the 60s, the 50s. And a lot of times they're not that cooperative with us.
Sure.
And not only that, is because we're asking for material that would incriminate their own. So they're hesitant to give us that material. And then you have to talk to the families as well. And in the abstract, this does sound like a good idea, but a lot of families have moved on from the 50s and 60s, and they don't want to open up wounds. But also a lot of families do want that justice as well. So in forging that message to the families, you have to be very crafty, and you have to be very particular in what you say. You don't want to step on any toes. You don't want to hurt any feelings. You don't want to open up any wounds. And you only want to help the families that want that help. And that's why sometimes when we're being interviewed, a lot of times they want cases. And we have to be particular in the cases that we do give, because we may not have the discretion from the families to be able to talk about that. So there's a lot of difficulties that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
And Professor McDonald, when you come up against a roadblock, maybe one that's unexpected, how do you navigate around that? Or is it something sometimes you just have to say, we have to move on?
Well, I mean, we're taking on more than we can possibly succeed at. But we can succeed in a different way, and that is to keep this open, to keep saying to the Justice Department, to the local law enforcement, to the FBI, this is part of the responsibility, to saying to the public, this is part of our responsibility. We've got to find these things, and you need to do your job, too. We're a small piece in this, and yet we are finding things. And every time we find them, we turn them over. And if we have to embarrass them, we will, because they need to do their job. And I had one Justice Department lawyer say to me, well, what if you find 2,000? And he said, you don't expect me to prosecute 2,000? I said, yes, I do. And if lawyering and doing this kind of work and murder mean anything in our society, we can't bury it. We have got to go after them.
So what's the threshold? In other words, when you get information together, at what point are you able to reach a tipping point with the feds or with the local authorities to say, okay, we're going to reopen this?
Well, reopening it is both easy and difficult because it all is about definitions. It started with definitions. And when the Justice Department evidently means reopening, they're talking about paper reviews. Under the Emmett Till Act, which is not what the Emmett Till Act describes, but they're talking about looking at the old documents, looking at the old FBI reports. But you have to know that at that time, it would have been a death warrant for a lot of people to come forward. And now those people are coming forward. We've talked to a lot of witnesses who were young people at the time. Mm-hmm. They were present and saw the results of their employer being burned to death or lynched or whatever, and they remember. But they couldn't say anything then. They would have been at the bottom of the river, too. So we expected full investigations by the FBI, to have special task forces, to have special units in cold case investigations. And part of our job is to embarrass them into doing that.
And one case where that has happened is the Moores Ford Bridge lynchings in Monroe, mm-hmm. 69 years ago. This weekend, there will be the annual reenactment of that. Two black couples were brutally murdered near that bridge in Monroe, Georgia. Alphonse, that case has been kept in the public eye, partly because of the efforts of now former state representative Tyrone Brooks. Are you going to be going there this weekend for the reenactment? And do you think now that the FBI has gotten involved again this year that there is progress being made on that investigation?
Yeah, it's great that you brought that up. That is one of the cases that we are working on. Myself in particular, we're working hand in hand with Representative Brooks on that case. And we will be in Monroe, Georgia for the reenactment. I believe what we're speaking as well. And we're going to do a lot of work in Monroe, Georgia for Moores Ford.
And he has implicated the FBI even in the murders, or at least some members of the FBI, some members of the law enforcement authorities. Meanwhile, he has run into some unrelated legal trouble himself and had to resign from the House of Representatives. Have authorities slowed down their work on this, do you think, because of what happened with Representative Brooks, or is it just not related at all?
I don't think that it's related because of the works of organizations like us that picks up where he left off and carries the ball to the next place that it has to go to. And that's why our work is so important, because we need to continue the work of who came before us. And because this is a case that occurred in 1946 and it's still relevant and prevalent today in our conversation.
We can't underestimate the importance of that case. It's a foundational case, not only because it's the early one, 46, and it's another one that's like, it's like the hunting down the Nazis from World War II. It's a message that says, this is something that's important to society to understand structural racist events, and we've got to get at it, and we can't give up. And I don't think Tyrone Brooks is giving up either. I mean, I think he'll devote full time now to this. So look out, world, because he's determined. He's determined to do this. So we're happy to work with him in support of that.
One thing you can feel here in this studio is your energy, and you've made a career of this. What does it mean to you to sit next to a student like Alphonse and kind of feel that energy reflected?
That's one of the great parts of the work, because my co-director, Paula Johnson, and I have worked with a number of students, and it has been transformative to many of them. Some of them start out not knowing anything about the civil rights history. They just kind of gravitate to this work, and then they discover all of this. And, you know, you can't understand, you read old newspapers, you're not only finding the particulars about one particular case, you're reading about what this really was like. And for a lot of young people, they're angry that they weren't taught this. And they're upset, and they relate it to Ferguson and to the things that are happening today. And so we have also crossed the line, and we're doing cases that happen today, too, and trying to get the Justice Department to do that. But it is, yeah, it keeps me going, because they may not go out and do cold cases, but they're going to be passionate advocates for whatever they do. And I feel pride in that.
And Alphonse Williams, is her pride, is her energy contagious?
Definitely. Every single day. It's the reason why we continue to work. And it takes a lot of passion and energy to do this kind of work. And you can't be scared. And her vigor, it rubs off on all of us.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Professor Janice McDonald, who is with Syracuse University's School of Law's Cold Case Justice Initiative, Alphonse Williams, one of the law students working on it, and a graduate of Grady High School right here in Atlanta. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Good luck.